Today at Reader's Corner, we welcome Arshe Cooper, author of A Most Beautiful Thing, the true story of America's first all-black high school rowing team. I'm Bob Custra. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Growing up on Chicago's west side in the 90s, Arshe Cooper knows the harsher side of life. Street corners full of gangs, hallways of his apartment complex haunted by drug addicts, his mother a recovering addict. Arshe spent his school days in the home ec kitchen dreaming of becoming a chef. And then one day, he notices a boat in the school lunchroom and a poster that reads, "Join the crew team." Having no idea what the sport of crew is, Arshe decides to take a chance. This decision to join is one that will forever change his life and those of his fellow teammates. Arshe and his teammates begin to come together to learn how to row. Many never have even been in the water before. While Arshe and his teammates face adversity at every turn, A Most Beautiful Thing is the inspiring story of a most unlikely band of brothers that form a family and forever change a sport and their lives for the better. It delivers an important and timely message of social justice and inclusion. Arshe Cooper is a rower, author, motivational speaker, and volunteer for numerous community outreach organizations. He works with nonprofits focused on opening the boathouse doors to everyone, and he was the recipient of a 2017 U.S. Rowing Golden Oars Award. Arshe Cooper, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Bob. I appreciate being on the show.
So, Arshe, listeners are always asking me, where do you get the idea for these books? And I have to admit that I don't even remember where I first saw your book. But when I opened it up, I knew I was going to have to talk to you. Because way back in the 90s, when you were in school, I was serving as lieutenant governor of Illinois. And one day in 1991, I believe, the Chicago Sun-Times wrote a major story about the neighborhood you grew up in. And the headline was, excuse me, but this was the headline, "A Walk Through Hell." And in the article, Father Mike Ivers of St. Agatha's Parish in North Lawndale was quoted as saying, "I just wish President Bush," that would be the first Bush, "and Governor Edgar, with whom I served, could come and walk with me through this neighborhood and help us do some things here." Well, I called up Father Mike that day and said, "I'm a poor substitute. I'm not the president of the United States. I'm not the governor of the state of Illinois. But as lieutenant governor, I'll come and walk with you." And I did. And it was the beginning of a lifelong friendship for years and years until Father Mike passed away a few years ago. My office staff went down at Christmas time and we organized, along with the parishioners, the Christmas present drive that gave presents to kids who were less fortunate than others. Father Mike and I just became fast friends, went to Mass on Sundays, brought my entire family down there. So I know something about North Lawndale, but I certainly am not in the position to describe it the way you can. And maybe the first thing we ought to do is have you tell our listeners what it was like growing up in the 90s in North Lawndale.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you for walking through the streets of Westside, the Westside L. I always appreciate those who want to help my neighborhood and still is helping a neighborhood like mine. Yeah, growing up in the 90s were rough, although there were great things like having MJ and the Bulls around and a few organizations that that helped. It was still pretty hard for someone like me, who mother was a drug addict and kid has never said dad a day in his life. And you're surrounded by gangs, by young people who were good people, but I wouldn't say made bad decisions, but the hard decision. Do I join the gang for protection? Do I steal or do I sell drugs to eat? And when you have a lot of young people making that decision, you in a neighborhood where you skip over pools of blood, right? You lose friends almost every other month. I ran for my life. I heard gunshots when I slept. You experience what most soldiers have experienced in war, but before you're 15 years old, while the brain is still developing. And I would say to myself, like, this is every day on the west side of Chicago, and it's rough. And, you know, and so you grow up searching for hope. You hear about this hope. You watch TV and you watch shows like A Different World and The Cosby Show, and hoping that you can live that life, but it's so far out of reach. And number one, it's because there's not a lot of access and opportunities to places, right? We have very few. St. Agatha was one of those places. And but you stay hopeful, but it's hard to keep that hope and keep that fire when you're losing friends every day.
Yeah, you mentioned those TV shows and the important role they played in your young life two or three times in the book, I think, and actually call out some of them as giving you a role model of what might be possible someday in your life, huh?
Yeah, that's what it was. It was, you know, like to be able to see those images of people who look like you living a life that seems really great and awesome. It gives you hope. They become, I mean, these are people you never meet, but they become your mentors. Those shows become your church service, right? And it gives you a lot of hope.
Yeah. You know, as I was listening to you just talk about what it's like walking the streets of your old neighborhood, I couldn't help but think back to Mike Royko, the once upon a time columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. He wrote a book called Boss, which was really the story of Richard J. Daley, the original Daley, mayor of Chicago. But at the beginning of the book, he talked about these white ethnic neighborhoods and how he would never cross over into a neighborhood that wasn't of the same ethnic origin as his, because you could get beat up pretty badly. Of course, in your day, it wasn't just getting beat up. It could be shot and killed thanks to the influence of guns. But you do mention in your book that that same problem was with you as you walked through North Lawndale. You had to be careful you didn't cross over into another neighborhood. I'll let you fill that out.
Yeah. It definitely. It wasn't just like, you know, I mean, it was hard enough in your neighborhood, but to go over to another neighborhood was, you know, people consider suicide. And I have to say that, I mean, there were times I remember, like, I mean, the city knew, the police knew it was so bad that, like, if you mouth off, the police would even drop you off in that different neighborhood if you thought you were, like, a tough guy. That's how crazy it was. In those other neighborhoods. And you know, it's a very segregated city. You're in a black neighborhood and there's a white out, you're in a Hispanic neighborhood and there's a white out in there. You're in a white neighborhood, right? And then goes back to black, Spanish, and white neighborhood. And so you just knew that you had to just stay around. And that's the reason why a lot of young people my age never seen downtown, because you have your family saying, don't take the train past these blocks, right? Right. So you have, you know, you can see it from the distance. You see the top of the Sears Tower at that time, but that's all you saw. And so for me, that's why I've never seen downtown. I was about 15 to 16 years old.
That's probably pretty difficult for a lot of people to understand. That's quite a revelation there. And I guess let's jump over to your high school years. Most guys your high school age go out for basketball or football. They hope to turn that into something that works for them in college. And of course, from my experience as president of Boise State, many of them who came to us to play football hoped that it would take them on to the pro ranks. You, on the other hand, found rowing, and you found it thanks to your infatuation with a young lady at your high school. You might want to share with us how this came about.
Yeah, I walked in the lunchroom one day and I see this boat, right? And I'm like, wow, like this is a nice boat. And I just stared, you know, I'd never seen a boat before. And this little white lady came and she tapped my shoulders. Hey, you want to be a part of the crew team? And I'm like, crew? Like, you know, like someone say join a crew, you run, you turn around and run as fast as you can. And so I was confused. I'm like, what? It's so many crews. I'm like, now there's a little white lady in the crew. What are you talking about? You know? And so I walk over to the TV monitor. And I see, she said, this is rowing. And the TV monitor is behind this boat. And I look at the TV monitor. Number one, there was, seemed like this might be something good for me, but there was hesitations because the images doesn't reflect, I felt like, the people I hang around with or I see every day. Like, the, you know, the team was, everyone was white. The officials were white. The fans were white. The boats were white. I was like, yeah, I don't know if I want to do this. So I said, oh, no. And I walked away. And I sat next to my friend Preston, and I was like, I can't believe they're here. We don't even swim. Why, they're trying to put us in a shell, you know? He was like, yeah, man, that's crazy, man. And so the next day, no one signed up that first. The next day I show up and there's a huge line. It says, get free pizza if you sign up. So all these kids are signing up. And I sit down and I tell my friend, like, no way. He's like, come on. And I was like, tell you what, you can hook me up with this girl, Grace. She was like the cheerleader, like lead cheerleader, smartest girl in the school. Like, absolutely, like, no shot. Like, dreams, like, talk about dreams. Like, that was a dream that was, like, far out of reach. And I was like, if you can connect me with her and just make an introduction, I would come to check out this rowing team with you. And he was like, deal, deal, deal. So at the school, I walk up to the gym room. And, again, hesitant, right? Because I'm like, I don't know if any black people do this sport. And why would I want to do that? Why would I want to be in the middle of the lake on a small shell, you know? But when I sat on the floor and this guy walks in and he talks about the sport, but the natural hesitations when he introduced the coaches and listening to his speech went away because, number one, while basketball coaches and football coaches pitch you on the sport, talking about the cheerleaders, the crowds, the money you can make, if you make it to the NBA, like all these dreams were not, it wasn't anything that was going to help me right away in my life. But this coach saying, if you join the rowing team, you would develop a brotherhood. I had one friend and that was Preston, that you would travel right away as a high school student. I'd never been anywhere. We would practice downtown. I'd never been there, right? You would learn how to swim. And culturally, I had a fear of water, that's scared, terrified. And these are all the things that will help me right now in my life. And it caught my attention. And the second thing, the fact that there was a coach, Coach Victor, someone who looked like me in a position of leadership. So I was like, oh my God, like, okay. And then there was a woman there, there was another coach. And back then in the 90s, football, basketball, baseball, you never seen women coaches for young men's team in high school. And so I was raised by women. Most of our teachers are women, so I felt comfortable with that. So having that diverse team really helped me to make the decision to myself and saying, this is something that I may want to try out.
I'm Bob Gustra here at Reader's Corner. We're talking with Arshay Cooper. He's the author of A Most Beautiful Thing, The True Story of America's First All-Black High School Rowing Team. Well, Arshay, you mentioned some of the people who really convinced you that this might be this crew idea might be something to work out in your life. And there's one guy in particular that I think I'm on safe ground saying, if it wasn't for Ken Alpert, maybe none of this would have happened. And I wonder if you could tell us about Ken, who I gather from your epilogue remains a good friend of yours to this day in his outfit Urban Options.
Yeah, yeah. Ken was he rowed at the University of Pennsylvania. He's from New Jersey, moved to Chicago, started a trading company, and started Urban Options, which first was based on youth entrepreneurship. And he had this belief that a lot of times kids go to, you know, kids on the west side of Chicago, there are kids that will graduate, go to college, experience a different world, and because it's something that they never had, they sometimes don't go back, right? But entrepreneurship was about understanding what your community need and the resources that it need and how you as a community member can provide that through entrepreneurship and provide opportunities and can help grow the community. And from there, he went into sports and entrepreneurship. And that's when he started in our school. And he was just a great dude, man. He, like, people will say he had balls because he would go. I mean, the moment before anyone joined the team, when we filled out those papers, he showed up at everyone's house or apartment to meet our parents. We were like, dude, what are you doing over here? You know what I mean? You can't come over here. You know what I mean? And he just wasn't scared. And I think, you know, he said in his speech that 9 schools said no. And our school said yes to the idea of starting this rowing team. But he believed that the lessons that this sport teaches can really help you the rest of your life. And not only he was just the funder, right? He didn't just give money, but he spent a lot of his time making sure that we were there when we were swimming or going to a trip with us and spending a lot of time with us. So he was just like a really good dude. And again, he wasn't just some guy who was like, I'm going to start a program. He actually like knew our families. He understood the community. He gave to a lot of other different programs that he believed in. And really good friend, right? Like very close with his family and his kids. Just a really, really good dude.
Yeah, at one point you say Ken is undoing what all the bad teachers and friends did to my self-esteem. That's quite a compliment to Ken, but it's also quite a commentary on some of the failures or the lackings of of the public school system, I guess.
Yeah, it was, you know, a lot of times you got teachers who are dealing with 30 kids in one class, and you can tell they just like ready to quit any moment or ready to cry, you know, and because of that, it's a lot of just like they're talking at you. You walk into the school, shut up, go in the classrooms, a lot of talking at you, right? And they didn't get the response that they need from young people, even when they were hurting. And what I liked about Ken, it was very gentle, right? And it was really understanding where we were coming from and asking a lot of questions. And I kind of said in my book, it was like, you know, you go to a bank and you try to, you know, make a withdrawal, but you don't get anything if you don't make a deposit. And he was making these deposits in our lives. And then when we had those bad days, we were always able to talk to him about it because of, he was always able to get a withdrawal because of the deposits he made in our lives. And, you know, and it was good. And not only just that, really giving us the St. Agatha jobs that we had in the summertime, Ken connected us to Father Mike, actually. Wow. Yeah, he the one connected us to have, we all got a summer job there. Me, Alvin, and Preston, and we worked in the summer because Ken connected us to him. Like, what do you guys need? How can I help? How can I help you stay together and be a part of a team? And he would go out and find it. And that was something special.
Boy, I didn't understand that connection with Father Mike. So when it comes to the sport of crew, we've seen boats on the water and we see how synchronized the movement is. But we also, those of us who are just reading about rowing, are probably thinking about our canoeing days or our kayaking days. You and your teammates had to do some pretty serious training just to get in shape before you ever got into the boat, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's hard work. You know, you have the erg machine, the rowing machine, which you have to pretty much be in shape to move that boat and also learn technique. It's all technique. It's hours and hours of technique. And the thing with this sport is, you know, you have someone like Shaq who can work on his jump shot for 20 years and still don't have a good jump shot, right? Or, mm-hmm. you know, or you have someone who's a pitcher and may work on hitting the ball for 20 years and still can't do it. And rowing is an input-output sport. What you put in is what you get out of it. It's not athletic ability. It's technique. And it is just moving together and it's power and all those things you can work on and you see yourself get better every single day. And so we understood that early on. So we had to do a lot of work. We had to get in shape, right? We had to be able to fit into the boat too. And that's what we loved about the sport is that we understood that you can be tall and that's good, but if you can spend hours beating on your craft, you will be better.
You're listening to R. Shea Cooper. He's the author of A Most Beautiful Thing, the true story of America's first all-black high school rowing team. So you mentioned Shaq. Shaq could achieve individual recognition in basketball or any ball sport, as you call him in the book. Not so much with crew. Help us understand the difference there and what role that probably plays as you move through life.
Yeah, I think with rowing, it's everybody coming together and moving as one. There are no timeouts. You step into that boat, you push out in open water. And that's what I think helped us connect, right? When you're a survivor, when you grow up in Chicago, you're a survivor because you hear gunshots and you run. Your survival mode is like run. And rowing, we was not only afraid of gunshots, but we were still afraid of the water. And I remember when we was pushed out in open water, survival mode said, okay, to not drown, to get back to the dock safely, you must pull together. And when you begin to pull together and drop that oar in at the same time, that's when you start to feel the magic in the boat. You begin to connect, right? And the water is peaceful. The sport is rhythmic, right? And so it actually reduces trauma. Instead of every sport I did, I tried out football and I wanted to fight because someone was trying to hurt me. I tried out basketball and it was a trash talking sport. And it reminded me of all the stuff that teachers and other people said about me. So I wanted to fight. But this non-conflict combative sport and being near the water, we all know what it's like to be near the water when it's raining or the ocean or in the shower. Like, it's so calm and peaceful. And so while teachers will call us a walking storm, this was the only sport that calmed the storm in us, but together, right? And so once we built that connection in the water and started moving together, that's when it became meditative. 2 hours a day, really great in our lives. And as you get better, it's also a sport that you begin to suffer because it's a lot of labor, right? but you're so tired and exhausted that you're like, we just want to go home. And you don't, no one's hanging out after practice in the streets because you're just so exhausted, you know? And so that's like the number one thing that the sport did for us, but it really helped us mentally. And those same lessons that you learn in the sport, we use in our lives. 90% of our team are entrepreneurs. 90% of people was on that Manly team are entrepreneurs and hire people from that community. And it was the lessons that our coach taught us. Like, number one, you have to leave the boathouse better than you found it, even if you don't make the mess, right? And every day what the coach was saying is that, how do you lead the sport? How do you lead the world? How do you lead the community better than you found it, even when you don't make the mess, right? Or one of the biggest lessons I learned is I can't do the work of 8 people, but I need 8 people in the boat to do the work, and we'll get there much faster. How do we accomplish things by moving together? And so when I became a chef, right, I understood those lessons of I need the whole 8 moving together to get there, to accomplish these goals. We have to hold each other accountable. Everyone has to show up, right? Everyone brings something different, but we're moving towards the same goals. And so those lessons that we learn while constantly dropping our oars in the water and moving forward with all the lessons that we was able to use for the rest of our lives.
Well, I can sure understand why you're a motivational speaker, Arshay. There's no doubt about that. I want to talk about your first meet. Your first competition was the Chicago Sprints. And there were some very sophisticated teams at that meet, including St. Ignatius and Loyola Academy, which, for our listeners who may not know, are very selective high schools in Chicago. Things didn't exactly go the way they were planned. Maybe you could, first of all, share with us how you and your teammates were sizing up these white guys, I think. I think they were all white. And secondly... why things didn't exactly work out the way you had planned.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, that first race, we was nervous, right? And we didn't understand what we were getting to. To be honest, like for me, like mentally prepping for a race is tough. As tough as the physical, for me specifically. And not only I felt like I had to prep myself physically or prep myself mentally, I felt like I had to get ready not only for race days, but race issues. And so that was in my head. And we were still excited and ready to go. And we understood that these kids, that we shared the same boathouse, right? That they had a well-funded team, they had better boats, right? Better coaches. But we wanted to prove that we were great. And they represent the kids from the other side of the river, and the river that we always just wanted to get across. And we got there, and it was so funny because I knew how well these guys move a boat. They've been doing it for a while, and it's just beautiful. And I'm like, I don't know how it's gonna happen. And I remember a guy had a tape recorder. He was interviewing one of the guys on the team, and the guy on the team was like, "It's gonna be like Jackie Robinson going to baseball, and Jesse Owens going to running. We're gonna dominate." And I'm like, "Oh no, gosh!" And so we get out there in the water, and this guy kind of made the lineup of the team who didn't spend a lot of time with us. And we went out there, and once that flag dropped, we started rowing. And then I remember we hit a brick wall. Gosh, I looked out there and I was just like, seeing all these white faces staring at me. And right away that doubt was like, you don't belong here. You don't have a right to be here. You ran into a brick wall. Like, you know, that whenever, you know, I feel like you do something that's out of the norm, and can give you a great future, that doubt always will come as a witness to remind you all the stuff you can't do. And that's what's going on in my head. And then we got back in a race and hit a wall twice. And that was because the port side had all the strong people on that side. And afterwards, I remember running into the locker room, just embarrassed, upset. And this guy who works at Parks, this black dude named Eugene, walks in. And he said, "Who said it's going to be easy?" And I was like, "What?" He said, "Who said it's going to be easy?" And he said, "Listen, you guys are doing something extraordinary. 20 years from now, no one's going to remember those kids, but they will remember you guys. But you have to keep doing it, you know?" And that's when I was like, "You're right. You know, I have to get back out there." But that was my first race, man. And I was ready to throw in the towel. But I'm always thankful for those individuals. Again, those people you don't know who drop these nuggets and these messages in your life to keep you going.
Yeah, I thought that's so interesting. I mean, here's an accidental encounter with a guy who's not in any way associated with rowing or high schools, or he's just taking care of the boathouse, and he's changing your whole attitude on on how to look at this one experience that could have been better. That's
And I think that's what I said, that message, right, that I learned, that I use today, is like, leave that simple lesson of leaving the boathouse how you found it. How do I leave this kid, or how do I leave this radio show, this podcast, the people who listen better than I found it? And I felt like we were surrounded by that. And that different environment was what we didn't get on the West Side. But when you have access and opportunity, that helps, you know? Mm-hmm.
You know, I really enjoyed getting to know your fellow teammates as you so beautifully portray them in this book. The one really sad note by the time I got to the end of your book was to read about Josh. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could tell us a little about Josh and why he made such a difference in the lives of you and your teammates. And then, unfortunately, this is where, I guess, Chicago's West Side comes back into play. What happened to him?
Yeah, you know, Josh was, he didn't join the team until the second year, actually. And that's when we was asked to go out and recruit kids. You know, he came to the info session and I wanted to recruit him because he was that kid that if they was having a spitting contest, he wanted to make sure he spit farther than you. Or if you, you know, if you take a shoe and he could throw it the farthest, you know, he'll do that. Or he'd play video games and stay up all night until he went. He was that kid. I was like, man, if we can just get that kid on this team, man, he's funny. You know, he had this dream of going to Second City, right, to study comedy. And he was the funniest guy ever we had in our school. And he joined our team. He was the youngest. We called him the baby brother of the team. He was very athletic, tall. You know, and because he was a little outgoing and a little out there sometimes, we had to, like, you know, keep an eye on him at these regattas, you know. but it was a world that he'd never seen and experienced. And sometimes we will lose him at the regattas, and he's talking to people and making people laugh. Just a good kid and great. He grew with us, and then, you know, right after high school, I mean, it's so many different stories out there, but the story is that there was a drive-by shooting on his block, and he was killed. And I mean, that was the saddest thing as a team that we had to go through, losing a friend, a teammate. And, you know, you think about the stress that caused on young people, right? You know, sometimes there's mass shootings in suburban schools, and right away they send in trauma counselors, which they should, but we had no one. This stuff happened all the time. There was one counselor in the school of 800 kids, you know, and we just have to cope with it. And for us, the water was our way to reduce all that stuff or try to talk to each other. But one of my teammate Malcolm will say is that, you know, a lot of stuff don't affect him because he's been seeing it since he was nine. And that's a tough mentality to have, you know?
So in the epilogue in your book, you share your experience attending La Cordon Bleu College and then your first gig as a young chef for the World Wrestling Entertainment. That sounds like that could be the subject of another book of yours, as well as you write. Tell us what that was all about.
Yeah, when I came home from La Cordon Bleu, so I went to La Cordon Bleu starting off in Chicago, and then got a job at Starbucks in Little Italy, and then I would start meeting all these people that had money that would come in, and I say, hey, ask them about their families. And then I went to Blackbird, which was this French restaurant and one of the best restaurants in the city of Chicago. And I was like, hey, can I work here for free? And they was like, absolutely. You know, I was like, I work on weekends. So I'm in school, I'm working at Starbucks, and I'm working at Blackbird. And I started making these business cards, and I would put it on the sleeve of the Starbucks cup. And I would start just getting business. Hey, I cater your families. I cater all this, you know. And then when I raised enough money doing that, catering to these families from Little Italy and these parties, I raised enough money to go to London, came back. My friend said, they're hiring for WWE wrestling. And I was like, listen, I'm not going to get that job. Like, you know, I'm just learning. I just finished school. He's like, I think you should apply. Drive down to Naperville for the interview and tell this guy the same story that I'm basically telling you, right?
Yeah,
how I interned for free, growing, where I came from, how I paid my way with cash through school, working at Starbucks and networking and working, doing all these great things. And you know, and there's all these other people who have a lot of experience who apply for the job. And I remember saying, I'm not going to get it. 2 days later, I get a call. Bobby says, you got the job. And what he said was like something that I tell every young person that really helped. He said that because of what you did as a 15, 16, 17 year old kid is the reason why you have the job now. And so it's so important, like what you do now as a young person, what you do in the time of COVID, how you treat the person next to you, right? Matters until the day you die, right? It could be 10 years later. What you do today can really determine the outcome of your future. And that world was amazing. Like John Cena, The Undertaker, all these people you grew up watching on TV, you're like one of their chefs, right? And you're cooking for them. And it was hilarious. It was awesome, but it was also tiring, right? It's a big job, 16-hour days. You go to an arena, you make the one room look like a restaurant, and you're cooking all day for breakfast, lunch. And you're not only cooking for wrestlers, you have the security crew, you have the refs, you have the camera crew, but you get a chance to know them, you know, and those guys are good guys, and it was a pretty good job.
So tell us about the U.S. Rowing Golden Oars Award that you received in 2017. What is that?
Yeah, that's an award that is given to someone who go just basically beyond measures of spreading the sport to people who normally wouldn't have access to the sport. For those who are making an impact on the sport. And I won the award for diversity, right? I've spent years going into cities that will call me and say, can you recruit at my school? And I would help them by speaking at 5 schools a day for a whole week, you know, recruiting kids. I will help them with youth development training. I will connect them with community leaders. I will help fundraise and cities after city after city in many different cities and help people start their programs that were kind of started the way ours started. And I also started a program in New York, right? Entrepreneurship and rowing program where 40 kids will show up every day, grinding, working, right? And it's basically the same lessons that I learned as a kid. It's the same lessons that I implement in some of these programs. And so I think that made an impact. And to see kids now that said that looks like me, or some who grew up like me, say, I heard you speak at my school 5 years ago, and I'm now growing at Williams, or I'm at Stanford, or I'm at Cal. You know what I mean? And it's just a beautiful thing. And I think U.S. Rowing recognized that impact, and I was able to win that award. And mostly programs win that award, but as an individual, I won that award.
Well, congratulations on the award and congratulations on the book. We've run out of time for questions, but I do want to remind our listeners once again that we're talking to Arshay Cooper, and the book is A Most Beautiful Thing, The True Story of America's First All-Black High School Rowing Team. And Arshay, maybe you can share with us where our listeners can find the documentary, which you have just completed, I believe, and will be running. Is it Amazon?
Yeah, so it's on Amazon at the end of the month. Right now it's free on Peacock. It's a new NBC streaming service. So you can find it there. It's exciting. It's awesome. It's inspiring. Again, you can find the book anywhere books are sold. And then also we started A Most Beautiful Thing Inclusion Fund that brings more of these opportunities into communities like mine through the sport of rowing.
Well, again, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.